Last week, we were trying to make the case for this picture. We've made it before, but the fact that James has structured his letter around the problems of temptation. You've all heard the joke about the guy that said, "I can resist anything but temptation." And we do kind of treat being tempted a bit lightly in our culture. Even as believers, the issue of temptation seems not to be too serious to many believers. But James obviously considered it a very serious issue. And in chapter 2, he dealt with the issue of the lust of the eyes, where the focus is on the acquisition of possessions as a foundation for providing for some sort of security. And of course, we know that that's an illusion. You're not secure by the abundance of the possessions that you possess. They can't make you secure. At any given point, we're only one heartbeat away from dying. Nothing that we possess can keep that from happening. So our security doesn't rest in our possession. Chapter 2 was written with that background in mind. And in chapter 3, he's moving over into this area of what John called the pride of life, or the arrogance of functional capacity. But the issue in this one is the search for significance or status, being elevated in the eyes of somebody to be somebody. And the power of disbelief in the promises of God is what gives these temptations their ability to break through the wall of faith and enter into the inner sanctuary of our life, which is supposed to be operating on the basis of the love of God and the faith in His Word. And in our study last time, we saw that James's exhortation in chapter 3, verse 1, that not many of us should strive to be teachers, is based on the twofold issues here in the fact that Paul deliberately taught in 1 Corinthians that teachers of the church are never such by the will of man. Men have no business abrogating to themselves the position of teaching in the church. Teaching for the church is a gifting that God grants by His own Spirit, by His sovereign direction. So teachers are never teachers of the church by the will of man. But at the same time, the men who have been gifted in that direction and refuse the will of God in developing that and functioning are always subject to an enormous level of shame at His coming. Because our gifting is the primary area of our stewardship responsibilities before God. So it behooves us to function within the realm of our gifting. And that means if we're not gifted to be a teacher, we shouldn't seek to be. And if we are, we shouldn't refuse to be. That's what Paul taught. The reason why James restricted the motivation for teaching was because of the historical reality there in Acts, where believers are not exempt from the same kinds of desires that unbelievers have. And one of the desires that unbelievers have, called the arrogance or the pride of life, is the desire to be somebody in the eyes of people. And in the historical setting in James's day, it was impossible for a believer to achieve status in the eyes of the majority of men. And therefore, if they were craving these accolades that this lust for status creates, if they couldn't be satisfied in the culture at large, then the only other place they could satisfy them, and that was in the church. And seeking to be a teacher in order to have status in the eyes of men is an absolutely pitiful basis for teaching. It's a foundation that will almost guarantee heresy sooner or later down the road, because it's a false motivation and it'll mess up the doctrine. So no one should seek to be a teacher who hasn't been summoned by God. If you remember, Moses and Jeremiah both tried to get out of the job, and Moses was called the meekest man on the earth. So meekness causes people to shy away from trying to be God's spokesman, but if God has called them, then they have no business rejecting the summons. In the times in history when Christianity is severely persecuted, then there will be an increase of desire among those believers who haven't settled the issue of their status at the cross. They will try to achieve some kind of status in the church. And of course, that usually makes for corruption and heresy. So when James opens chapter 3 with this command that not many of us should seek to be teachers, he did it on purpose because there's a great danger in teaching that is improperly motivated. If you'll look at the end of the chapter in verses 13 through 18, he point blankly says in verse 13, "Who among you is wise and understanding? Let him show by his good behavior his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, don't be arrogant and lie against the truth." That kind of wisdom comes from the earth. It's natural and demonic. But the wisdom that is from above is pure and peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. So chapter 3 is about this whole issue of seeking a position of influence in the church and being absolutely sure of the motivation that's driving that. And it does have its backgrounds in the historical setting. But quite frankly, you know, Paul said anybody who would live godly in Christ Jesus would suffer persecution. So there will probably never be a time when the church is really accepted by the culture, and it shouldn't be. Because the culture is from this world, and it's under the influence of the prince of the power of the air, and any church that is popular in that setting is obviously accommodating. So, this evening what we want to do is pick up in our study and look at verse 2 particularly. James's focus in this demand that not many of us be teachers at the end of verse 1 of chapter 3 is the focus on judgment. He says that we who are teachers, and he was including himself in that, will incur a stricter judgment. And so one of the things that's true of James in his writing to his readers is that he maintains a fairly high visibility focus on this issue of the judgment of God. I'd like to point that out. In the first place, it's impossible to make a command without assuming that there's some kind of a judgment. Any command, any truth demand, has to be responded to by some kind of a choice. And if the choice is a choice to obey, it yields joy. And if it's a choice to disobey, it creates an experience of death to some degree. Now, obviously, both of these issues are relative. I mean, there's Peter's statement of joy inexpressible and full of glory. And there's the psalmist's statement, "At thy right hand is fullness of joy," or "In thy presence is fullness of joy, at thy right hand pleasures forevermore." So there's all kinds of relative levels of joy. There's also relative levels of the experience of death. We don't have to physically die to experience the consequences of death, because the wages of sin is death, and anybody that succumbs to temptation tastes the bitterness of some kind of death, even though it may not be physical. There's physical death and emotional death and spiritual death, and you can experience the emotional and spiritual without physically dying, at least to some degree. So James writes his book understanding that the twin pillars of any command are blessing and cursing. There's a blessing for obedience and there's a cursing for disobedience, and that's true whether you're talking in the Old Testament under that dispensational setting or whether you're talking about it right now. Because in the church, there's blessing and cursing too. God actively operates to bless those who trust him, and he actively disciplines those who disobey him, and it's there. And in both cases, blessing and cursing, each require special divine involvement. So God is involved with his children. So when James makes this command, there is the specter of judgment behind the demand, and there always will be. Every demand requires a choice, and every choice has its own result. So what we do or don't do is going to bring about its own consequence, and it could be joy, could be the experience of death. But that's just an assumption that behind every command. But in James's command here, he has already set up in his book and maintained a fairly consistent thesis of living in light of the judgment to come. If you remember in chapter 1, verse 2, he said, "Consider it all joy when you fall into various temptations or trials, and to consider all joy as a perspective on the ultimate joy of the Bema Seat and what's going to come out of the judgment seat of Christ. That implies judgment. In verse 12 of chapter 1, he said, "Blessed is the man who perseveres, because once he's been approved, he'll receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him." That crown of life is a reward that comes out of the judgment seat of Christ. In chapter 1, verse 15, he says, "When lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it's accomplished, brings forth death. Death is the consequence of judgment." In verse 25, he said, "The one who looks into the law, the perfect law, intently, and abides by it, becomes blessed in what he does." And that's outworking of God's decision based on the person abiding in the law of liberty to produce blessing in his life. Chapter 2, verse 5, he says, "God has chosen the rich in faith to be the heirs of the kingdom." That's a judgment theme where he rewards those who depend on him. Chapter 2, verses 12 and 13, he point blankly says, "Act and speak as those who are going to be judged by the law of liberty, because judgment will be merciless to the one who's shown no mercy, and mercy triumphs over judgment." Chapter 3, verse 1, "We shall incur stricter judgment." Chapter 4, verse 6, he gives greater grace. God is opposed to the proud, gives grace to the humble. That's an activity of judgment where he makes decisions on how he's going to respond based on the attitude we take. Chapter 4, verse 10, "Humble yourselves in the presence of the Lord, and he'll exalt you." That's an activity of his judgment, responding to our attitude. Verse 12 says point blankly, "There's only one lawgiver and judge, the one who's able to save and to destroy." So he brings this issue of God's judgment back into place. In chapter 5, verse 1, "Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries which are coming upon you." It's a judgment theme, runs all the way down through verse 6. Verse 7 and 8 and 9 point blankly says, "Be patient till the coming of the Lord." The coming of the Lord is at hand, verse 8. The judge is standing right at the door, verse 9. And then in chapter 5, verse 12, he says, "Don't swear either by heaven or earth or with any other oath. Let your yes be yes, your no, no, so that you may not fall under judgment." So, just real quick, we've gone through and pointed out the fact that James has an overriding judgment thesis throughout his entire book. He lives under and teaches and exhorts us under the thesis that what we do makes a difference. The choices we make have a direct impact on the way we're going to experience life down the road. That's built in. That's the way life is. And he wants us to be sure we understand that, because dealing with temptation is no real light matter. It's a serious thing. The consequences of our choices come. Paul said it, "Be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatsoever man sows, that shall he also reap." So James made the foundation of chapter 3 in this command about not seeking status in the church based on this position of teaching. Not to do that for that reason, in order to get the status, because he says at the end of the verse, verse 1, that we're going to come under stricter judgment. Now, those of you who have the King James, it says, "For we shall incur greater condemnation." Nobody has a King James. Well, then the King James translators use the word condemnation. That's misleading, because Paul pointedly said in Romans 8:1, "There is therefore now no condemnation to them that are in Christ Jesus." And to translate the word that's in James 3:1 as condemnation is simply a mistake. It should just simply be judgment. There is a strict difference in the New Testament between condemnation and judgment. Condemnation means hell. Judgment simply means that God makes a decision and carries it out. In your case, it can be good or bad. Depends on what you've chosen to do in that. The Apostle Paul taught that we will all stand before the judgment seat of Christ and give an answer for the deeds done in the body, whether good or bad. Therefore, knowing the terror of the Lord, and so on. So, going into the judgment seat is not going to be all smiles and giggles and fun. The judgment that's made there is going to cost us if we have disobeyed, if we've fallen into any of these temptations and lived within their confines. There is such a thing as having real consequences both in pain and pleasure after and at the judgment seat of Christ. There's a lot of believers who think that the judgment seat of Christ is not going to have any pain involved. But that can't be true. It cannot be true. John said that we should abide in him so that we will not be ashamed before him at his coming. And shame is one of the most painful emotions you'll ever experience. Just because he doesn't beat us with a cat of nine tails does not mean that we're going to get off scot-free. And, in fact, there's not even any guarantee he won't beat you with a cat of nine tails. The scriptures do teach about the person who didn't do the will of the master, and so he received few stripes because he did it in ignorance, and the other one received many stripes because he did it willfully. So I'm not going to guarantee you that sinful behavior isn't going to cost you even some physical pain at the judgment seat, but I don't have a particular text that would guarantee that you will. I do have a text, though, that says you'll be ashamed if you succumb to temptation and live in that sphere, and that is painful, being ashamed, especially in public shame. And the Bema seat apparently is going to be relatively public. So, judgment is an underlying thing, and it makes for, in chapter 3, verses 1 and 2, it makes for a very sobering introduction to this entire thesis. But it should be that way, because the lust of the flesh is a significant problem. The lust of the eyes is a significant problem. But it was the arrogance of functional capacity that introduced sin into the universe. That was the sin that Satan tripped over. And it was the one that he finally got Eve to trip by means of. She saw the fruit was good to eat. She saw that it was desirable for her eyes. But it was the promise that she would be as God that got her. And that's the functional capacity arrogance that Satan used. So chapter 3 is dealing with the most critical issue of life. And that is, where are you going to get your sense of significance? And if you get it anywhere but at the cross, where the God who made you died for you, then you're already into the lust for status in some other place. Your status comes directly off the fact that the God who made you died for you. If you find it anywhere else or seek to get it anywhere else, you're already involved in the sin of the arrogance of functional capacity. Now, having said that, I want to ask the question, since judgment is one of his major themes, what's the criterion that he uses in his judgment? And I believe that verse 2 tells us. It says in verse 2 that we all stumble in many ways. If anyone doesn't stumble in what he says, he's a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body as well. Now, it's kind of interesting. There's a little tension here in James, because in chapter 1, he said in verse 26, if anyone thinks himself or seems to be religious and yet doesn't bridle his tongue, his religion's worthless. But then over in chapter 3, he says, if you can bridle your tongue, you're perfect. So you run into this tension of thinking, well, is he saying then your religion's vain if you're not perfect? And that can't be, because he starts the verse off by saying, well, some will many ways. I believe that the resolution of that tension is simply that in chapter 1, when he says, if anyone thinks himself or seems to be religious, depends on how you want to translate that verb, and doesn't bridle his tongue, but deceives his own heart, his religion's worthless. He's talking about a person who wants to have the status or the recognition of being, quote, religious, unquote, which typically in James's mind is being spiritually mature. So in James 1, he's dealing with the same thing he's dealing with in James 3, and that's the person who wants to be perceived as being spiritually mature. And he says in verse 26 of chapter 1, if a person wants to be perceived as being religious or spiritually mature, but he hasn't bridled his tongue, he hadn't got there. His religion's vain. Because according to chapter 3, verse 2, spiritual maturity means that you're able to bridle your tongue. That's what he says. A person who is able to bridle his tongue, he doesn't stumble in what he says. He's a telos. He's a mature man who's able to bridle the whole body as well. Now, this verse tells us two or three or four or five things. In the first place, I believe it's dealing with the James's understanding of the criterion that God is going to use to exercise judgment. What's he going to hold us up against as a standard at the judgment seat? Well, in the first place, he starts off with this concept of stumbling. He says we all stumble many ways. Stumbling is a metaphor out of the physical process of walking. It simply means that you don't get the foot that needs to be in front of you quite right. You've hooked it on something and it isn't moved forward. And so instead of having your foot there to hold you up, you start to go down because something has held your foot up. That's what we call stumbling. You catch your foot on something and therefore it's not out in front of you to catch your weight as you've been moving forward. That's the reality of walking, and stumbling is a metaphor that's built off of that, and it simply means that God has a standard by which he defines the failure to walk properly. He expects us to walk properly. If we don't, we stumble. He has a standard then for proper walking. And when we cease or fail to walk properly, we stumble. Now, the Bible makes a distinction between stumbling that leads to a complete fall and stumbling that simply means that you've caught yourself. You're not walking like you should be, but you've caught yourself. You haven't fallen. For example, in Romans 11:11, Paul asks, has Israel stumbled so as to fall? And the idea there is to completely be out of the picture. And his answer is no. And in 2 Peter 1, he says, if you do these things, you'll never stumble. Again, the translators dropped the ball on the King James there because they said you'd never fall. But there's a difference between stumbling and falling, and it ought to be maintained. But the point is, the Scriptures tell us that there is a way to walk, and God's going to hold us accountable for walking that way. And if we don't walk that way, he considers it a stumble. Now, you can stumble and fall, or you can stumble and catch yourself, and then begin to walk again. And, of course, that's what 1 John's about. When you stumble and begin to fall, if you confess your sins, he's faithful and just to forgive us. He cleanses us, and we're back into the walk again. That's ideal, and that's one of the things that God's going to use as his criteria for judgment, is how did we walk? And then secondly, he moves directly into the issue of what we have to say. He says in verse 2, we all stumble many ways if anyone doesn't stumble in what he says. Literally, that says if he doesn't stumble in the words, in the word. And what he's talking about is in regard to verse 1, where the teacher is supposed to be teaching the word so that people can walk properly, and the person who doesn't stumble in the word, in what he has to say as he's teaching this word, he's a telos. He's a complete man. He's a mature man who's then able also to bridle the other elements of his body. But the point of the word, stumbling in what he has to say, indicates that James freely acknowledges a large degree of guilt upon us all. We all stumble many ways. But he focuses on the kind of guilt that comes from the improper use of the word, the words that we use to communicate the word, which indicates that James has a particular focus on the judgment of God. I don't know if you stop to think about it. There's an interesting summary of David's life in the Old Testament that says that David did everything God wanted him to do except in the Bathsheba thing. It doesn't say it exactly like that, but basically, it just kind of whitewashes David's whole life except for the Bathsheba event. That's kind of interesting. I can find lots of things that David didn't do right. And God just wiped it off. He said that the Bathsheba thing was the thing that really David failed in. Well, James seems to imply in verse 2 that God doesn't expect perfection. We all stumble many ways. For a person who's going to teach, he does expect extreme caution in the word. Why is that? Well, words are the root of the power of life. They really are. You mold people by the things you say. especially parents. But all of us do. Words are the root of our ability to interact with each other. And we antagonize each other more with words than anything else. Or we encourage one another more with words than with anything else. Now, obviously, we're supposed to love not in tongue or in word, but in deed and truth. So there's got to be some stuff that comes behind the words. But the words are where it all starts. And it's really interesting that James puts that out. And in fact, Jesus even said, the words that I speak to you, they are spirit and they are life. So the power of the spoken word, the power of the words, is a critical power. And James is saying that God's intention is for all of us to come to maturity in the word. Because, he says, the guy who is able to not stumble in what he says is the telos man. Telos is the word in the scripture that refers to God's objective, what has been accomplished, what he is shooting to accomplish. If God's description of a man as telos is that he is able to not stumble in what he says, then that tells you what God is looking for. And if that tells you what God's looking for, suddenly we have a criterion for his judgment. He's going to judge us according to whether we grew up in the word and being able to be truthful in the things we say. So God's standard for judgment will be man's arrival or lack thereof at the standard of the telos, which is being able to control your words. Because if you can control what you say, if you don't stumble in what you say, then you can control the rest of yourself. So he says, able to bridle the whole body. So the criteria has to do with walking, because the stumbling is an issue of walking. It has to do with walking in particular in relation to the words of truth. And it tells us that God's definition of a perfect man is a man who's able to not falter at the word level. In other words, he believes the truth and he operates by it and he speaks it. And for teachers, that's critical, because it's not truth, heresy. Now, there is a more fundamental objective than simply becoming word perfect. That's a computer program. But becoming word perfect is not a final goal. Why would we want to become word perfect? Well, because life flows out of the words. Communication is the essence of the mechanism of life. Constantly we're told that relational breakdowns caused by lack of good communication, sometimes it's caused by too much good communication of bad things, but faulty communication, whether it's poorly chosen words or not communicating enough, at any rate, relationships start to break apart because of that. Well, if that's really true, then God's desire for us to be able to speak well, to speak true words with good impact, is because that's where the relationships flourish. And that's what he wants for us. Because life's essence is in relational harmony. God came so that we might be able to have peace with him, and peace with him is a relational harmony issue between us and him. So God's standard judgment will be his objective of men becoming life communicators by the words they speak. And he's going to evaluate everybody by that standard. Everybody. But teachers, he's going to evaluate even more strictly by that standard. Because the teachers have the influence. I was tickled to death to read that the United Methodist Church decided to go with the biblical position in their conflict. Woe be to the leadership of churches that decide not to go. Because God's going to hold the leaders strictly accountable as to whether they went by what his word says. It really doesn't matter what psychology says or science says or pseudo-intellectualism or philosophy. It doesn't matter. God has said what he has to say, and he expects his teachers of his church to go by what he said. And he's going to hold us accountable for it. So he's going to hold all believers accountable for their development in becoming word perfect. That is, understanding doctrine, believing it, operating by it, sharing it, and so on. But he's going to hold the teachers primarily responsible because they're the ones who control basically what is heard in the church. Okay? That, I think, is the reason why verse 2 is in there. It establishes for us an understanding of what the judgment's going to be all about. It's going to be about whether we grew up in the truth. Again, to use the words that would communicate life. Any questions or comments? The thing that's most critical for us to understand is that we have a built-in drive to be significant, and we must handle that at the cross, because our significance is defined at the cross. If our God died for us, we are significant. If we reject that, God is going to flip us off, and that's a real flippant way of saying it, but he is going to flip us off into the lake of fire. And you know what that's ultimately a statement of? You have no significance to me. You're worthless to me. I don't want you in my presence. I want you out of here. And there isn't going to be anything more humiliating to an ego-driven person than to hear that. You're worthless from the God who made you. So you either handle it at the cross, or you end up in the fire. And for believers who have come to the cross, we subscribe with our minds and some agree with our hearts that we believe that our God died for us. Well, that should solve the temptation of the pride of life. That it doesn't simply testify to the strength of the pull to try to be significant in the eyes of others besides God.